we're on the air. Thank you, Ryan. We'll open a work session on, no, a public hearing on House Bill 179A. And Representative Greenleck, you are Senate Bill 179A.
Yes, I am willing to talk. We had several meetings on 179. Is Troy here? Where? I saw him there before. Yeah. Here is where it came down, and the piece of information that we had missing at the last session that cleared up for me was, and Troy can talk more about it, is that every school district, because of the uniform signing code, will have a specific sign that explains what the situation is in that school zone. So that if it's a 24-hour school zone, it will be signed to say, speed limit 20 miles an hour, all hours, all days. If it's a flashing red light, a flashing yellow light, it'll have a sign saying 20 miles an hour when lights are flashing. If it's a timed period, it will have a sign in every school zone in both directions that says 20 mile an hour speed limit, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. or whatever that district is. So as a driver, you don't have to come into school, into the zone and say, my God, how does the law apply here? You just have to read the signs. And I think that sort of clarifies it. We had some discussion about why there are the two different, I talked to Senator Starr about why there are the two different ones, and that's because there were some political discussions about what made sense, and that was a political compromise. But I came away with the feeling that as long as we were clear about the signage, then that takes away the ambiguity. Janet also is passing out now the fine matrix for the signs. You also have the fine matrix, which points out that not all school zones have a double fine. It's only school zones that are marked fines double in school zone that has a double fine, and there is a variety of fines in the matrix based on how many miles over the speed limit you're going and what the circumstances is. And you were going to distribute that as well?
Mr. Chair, that's at People's Place today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenleaf. Senator Beyer, apologize for being late. Never happens in the Senate side, does it?
Of course not. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I'm here today to support the A.N. Groth version of Senate Bill 179. And this bill, I worked with Troy and Senator Starr in the House, in the Senate, to work on this bill. I introduced a bill that is still in the committee. We used this vehicle because it was already there. But and I won't speak to the part about the bill that is 20 miles an hour, 24/7. That was Senator Starr's issue. That was not my issue. My issue is the part of the bill that deals with the school zones along high-speed highways in the rural parts of the state. And since I have been a representative and now a senator in my district, I have received just about more complaints or more constituent calls on the school zone issue than just about any other issue. And the reason that is, in my district, and I think it's very common in many rural districts around the state, and my district, even though it's in the Willamette Valley and touches I-5, is still a rural district. In fact, when I served in the House, I had the only district in the state without a traffic light in it.
So you didn't manage to get one for your district.
Huh?
You didn't manage to get one for your district.
I didn't want one. But, Mr. Chair, I have schools in my district that are located right next to state highways. And one in particular was one that is on a blind corner on an uphill. You're approaching the school, and you cannot see the school until you are there. The school zone sign is there. You have no idea if there are children are present or not. And that one particular school zone generated more complaints in my district than any other school zone, probably all the rest of them combined. But after the 1990, I think it was after the 1997 session, but it might have been 99, when I had introduced a bill to require blinking lights and that bill failed to pass, that school went and put a blinking light marking their school zone. There's now a blinking yellow light there, and this is Butte Creek School. It's over between Silverton and Molalla, if you've ever gone through that area. And since they did that, I have had zero complaints about that school zone. That demonstrated to me, and when the bill was in the Senate committee, we asked if maybe we could get an estimate on the cost that it has cost the school district or the ODOT, whoever it was, put those blinking lights up. But it completely eliminated the issue, because you now know when you're a driver there that if the lights are blinking, whether you can see the school or not, you slow down or you will be in violation. And that it took the ambiguity out of the law. And because of the cost issue, we asked, we put in, and this is, it's in the bill, that if there aren't blinking lights, that the sign would have the times posted on it. And Representative Greenlick was exactly right. The signs would all still be there. You'd have a sign saying school zone ahead, and you'd have another sign saying it's the 20 miles an hour at these posted times. And it would be up to, in my vision, it would be up to the school working with the local road authorities to post, to figure out what time it is that they want posted on the signs, just like it's up to the schools now to turn on and off those blinking yellow lights. That's who makes the decision when there's children there. If we do that, I think we will eliminate the ambiguity of the thing currently in the law, because people don't know what it means today, when children are present. That's a complete a term that has, you know, no meaning. If you're going 55 miles an hour down a highway and you've got a log truck or a semi truck right behind you, and you've got, you're coming to a school zone, you've got two bad choices. You either slow down to 20 right away and risk getting rear-ended, or you go through faster than that and risk getting a ticket, or much worse, risking the life of the child. So if we do this, the Senate Bill 179, I think it's going to make the rural school zones in Oregon much safer and be much better for drivers, so we can let them, everyone has assurance of what the law is. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any. Otherwise, I'll go back to committee.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I agree, the blinking lights are the most effective if they could afford more than each. But the signings definitely will help also in some situations. There's a rural school just south of Philomath on a county road that's a popular cut-through road to when you're headed for Eugene. And you come over a brink of a hill, and there's the school down below, and you're right on it immediately. And they recently put up blinking lights there to warn you when that school zone is active, and it makes a big difference. And it makes it work. Makes the zone work like it should. Thank you, Senator. Is there any questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Troy.
Mr. Chair, I was just here in case there were any questions when Representative Greenlick had called my name, so I thought I would come up here just in case there was a
Dee
question.
Bridges?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dee Bridges, Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. I don't really need to say a whole lot more than what Senator Beyer did. I would maybe explain, going back several sessions ago before the existing law was passed, the problem that caused that law to be changed was that we had some rural school districts that a very few of them, but some nevertheless, were at 4 o'clock in the morning. The local gendarmes had nothing better to do, I guess, and would go out and sit in front of a rural school district and nab log truckers on the way to work at 4 o'clock in the morning for going through a school zone at 55 miles an hour. So that gave rise to this present law, and I'm totally comfortable with the way it reads right now. I'm not very much concerned about what happens in rural areas where you have to slow down from 30 miles an hour to 20 miles. That's not a problem. But if you're in a rural area, I'm in an urban area there. If you're in a rural area and you have to slow down from 55 to 20, it's just dumb to do that. So people don't and risk getting ticketed. There was a question what the original this original bill did, I believe, was define when children are present, because the existing law was kind of ambiguous as to what that meant. And are children present if they're behind a chain link fence? Are children present if they're inside the school building? So the original bill, I think, attempted to resolve that situation, and then this amendment eliminated the need for that except in a crosswalk. And I think the bill's just great the way it is.
Thank you, Dee. Is there any questions? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Christy Monson. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, Christy Munson representing the League of Oregon Cities. You have written testimony before you that the League is neutral on the bill. We were just writing to inform the committee that there is a fiscal impact. It's not been assessed to be a significant one, but we just wanted the committee to have that information before you. We also have been informed as far as the public outreach that needs to be done regarding the change from 24/7 to when children are present will be handled by ODOT. If there is holes or if cities feel that they need to do other public outreach, that will be an expense also on cities. But otherwise, we're neutral on the bill.
Thank you, Christy. Is there any questions? The cost figure you have, $7,200, that's for all cities?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure if you're looking at our testimony, Chair Brown. I didn't give a...
Okay.
Now, for Redmond, it looks like, I think they were giving an average.
Oh, an average.
It says right here that it's city of Redmond.
Oh, the city's the size of Redmond. Okay.
Yeah, city size of Redmond.
All right. Understand. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a quick question.
Representative Garr.
Right now, from the testimony, any of the flashing lights that have been put up by schools, or maybe I'm wrong on that. Does this in any way obligate the city to do flashing signs?
Chair Brown, Representative Beyer, our reading of the bill is that it does not. If there is an area 35 miles per hour or higher, you may have flashing lights or you may indicate the school zone by signs. So if you do have a school zone in an area of 35 miles per hour, you may have an obligation to put up signs if you do not already have them there.
Okay. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 179? We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 179A.
Mr. Chair, I move we refer 179A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Amendment?
Mr. Chair?
I think it's currently amended.
Oh. Is there
Mr. Chair, at the meeting on April 28th, you did adopt the -A2 amendments, so that they're already adopted.
So is B-179 as amended to the
right.
Right.
And those were technical amendments requested by Legislative Council.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. Representative Greenlick moves the Senate Bill 179 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, I just want to indicate that I will be a yes now. I think I understand it now.
Thank you, Representative. I think we all understand it now. Is there any other discussion? Hearing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Eichholder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carried. Do we dare put this on? I think it. We need a carrier. Representative Gilman. Okay. Thank you. Representative Gilman will carry. Let's see, which one are we on now?
We've got people here for both.
Let's do, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3628. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on this?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3628 is the Phoenix Bill. It arose from the ashes of House Bill.
Come up from the bottom.
Yeah.
It sunk.
It was in danger of sinking as House Bill 2685 because of the narrow relating clause. And when we talked to Legislative Council about, when the proponents talked to Legislative Council about amendments, Council said it was too narrow of a relating clause for their amendments, but they also discovered that it was even a too narrow of a relating clause for the bill that they had written, the original bill. So Council suggested starting over, and we got permission from the Speaker's office to do that at this late date because it was Council's suggestion. So now you have House Bill 3628. You did have hearings on April 7th and April 16th, but there are a couple of changes in the bill since that time. So another thing, just before I forget, it does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. This is the bill that would authorize ports to remove and dispose of abandoned boats, floating homes, and boathouses. And there are provisions in the new bill that would also allow them to use some of the funds to remove other hazards to navigation. There are new fees in the bill at $1 for boats under 26 feet, $5 for boats 16 feet or more, and $10 for commercial boats. Something that's in this bill that was not in the original bill, again because of the relating clause, but was wanted by the proponents, is a increase in one-time title fees for floating homes and boathouses. The other fees I was talking about are biennial fees. The additional fees. This is a one-time fee when you title a boathouse or a boat, a floating home, is now $20 and it goes to $50. Again, when you retitle, you would have to pay that again if the title is transferred. So the additional fees are dedicated to the cleanup account. Ports that used some of these funds from the Marine Board would have to match it by 25% match, and there's a limit on the amount that can be spent of the new revenue of $150,000 a biennium on these kinds of cleanup costs, so that any additional money would go into the regular boating fund for marine facilities. So there's a number of proponents that you've in the audience on this bill, and that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have a sign-up list? Or? Let's see, could I have Ken Armstrong, Don Mann, and Paul Don Hefner, please? Actually, Phil, if you'd drag up another chair, we could squeeze all four of you in there at one time, I think. The four horsemen, yeah.
Mr. Chair, yeah, the four horsemen. What we thought before was the apocalypse is now getting better. I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. Staff did an excellent job of summarizing where we're at. I think all of the issues that are reflected in this bill, with the exception of the $30 for the floating homes and houseboats, we have talked about either because they were in an amendment in the original bill or was a conceptual change that we were talking about trying to accommodate. I think what you see here are some changes that that tighten up the bill, that resolve some concerns that the Marine Board wanted to see included in the bill, that through our discussions with the Northwest Steelheaders helps, I think, give them some things that make it more appealing and a little bit less one-sided, but I'll certainly let Mr. Donovan speak to that. Again, your staff has summarized the details of the bill, and I've got a couple other people here who are going to testify, so I'll just kick it over to them, but we do appreciate the committee's indulgence in bringing this bill back to for consideration. Don.
Mr. Chairman, and other members, thanks for given the opportunity to testify today. My name is Don Mann. I'm the general manager of the Port of Newport. And special thanks to Chairman Brown, one of our former port commissioners, and thanks to Ken and the Oregon Ports Group. I brought this idea to the Ports Group in relating to other states that have a similar bill for assistance in getting attending abandoned or derelict vessels. The support for creating this abandoned boat removal and cleanup account is very important to the ports in Oregon. I would also like to thank the Oregon State Marine Board Director, Paul Dunhafter, for his assistance in helping create a mechanism for this to be possible and to assist the ports to eliminate potential environmental and navigation hazards such as abandoned pilings, logs, deadheads that presently have and potentially could have the opportunity to burden Oregon's waterways. The proposal you have before you now is formerly 2865, as was discussed, and I thank staff for their overview, and as Ken said, it's right on target. The after all other avenues of applicable funding are exhausted, the this bill or the funding from this bill would assist the ports, the cleanup and removal of abandoned derelict vessels up to 200 gross tons, including the salvage, towing, and storage, and a disposal not to exceed 75% of the incurred costs, and only after, again, all efforts have failed to collect from the owner's insurance or the owner himself or herself. There have been on occasion in our port alone when vessels, both recreational and commercial, have simply been abandoned on port property or within our jurisdiction, and the port has expended funds beyond the operation and maintenance budget that we normally have line item for. Just recently, we've had to take care of three such vessels that were abandoned at our docks and that were in our district. Vessels were abandoned. The approximate man hours was 44 man hours to dispose of these vessels. Presently, they have been taken out of the water, placed on shore, and it's up to us now at this point to dispose of them. We were just told by our local fire chief that this is the last time we'll be able to burn these types of vessels due to environmental concerns. So at this point, we have to take these types of vessels out of the water. They have to be broken up, placed in proper disposal, and then hauled off to a landfill. So the process keeps getting even more expensive. There was no assistance from the owners, of course, nor was there any insurance to be found for this. And I'd also throw in that the owners were nowhere to be found, nor do they ever leave a forwarding address for us to track them down. This proposed bill would be provided would provide for no more than $150,000 per biennium, which was explained earlier, about 50 cents a year, to be deposited in this subaccount. Any remaining monies collected shall be deposited in the boating safety, law enforcement, and facility account to the benefit of all Oregon waterway users. This is a good bill and an excellent tool for ports and the Oregon State Marine Board. I urge you to move this bill with a due pass. Thank you.
Don, if I know up the bay up to, by Riverbend, there's at least one vessel that was abandoned and sunk just off of the channel. Would these type of dollars be available then to clean up those? I know, and there wasn't anyone wanted to claim ownership for that. There was a lot of finger pointing going back and forth at all the agencies, and no one wanted it because there's cost involved in getting that thing refloated and getting it out of there. Would this cover that type?
Chairman Brown, yes. The short answer to that is why I presented this idea to begin with, because of that, those kinds of vessels. Even though we still have not exhausted, or there has been no pressure from the Coast Guard or the Army Corps of Engineers toward the owner, which the owner is still in the area. And if all fails, this type of a program or account could be used for that kind of vessel.
Ken, do you know if I know what happened on Yaquina Bay, but does this happen on the other harbors and bays up and down the coastline or on the Columbia River?
Mr. Chair, I would probably direct this more towards Marine Board Director Don Hefner. I don't think that there's a preponderance of these kinds of vessels, but when they're there, they're a definite problem. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to cap the fund at $150,000. What we don't want to see happen is see a fund just build up till you've got, you know, $1 million or something like it, that in there, and it's just not being used at that sort of a rate. So we want to have it be a little bit tied towards what in reality is happening out there, but I think Mr. Don Hafner would be able to better explain what the status is.
Paul?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, I'm Paul Don Hafner, Director of the Marine Board. This is a problem that crops up in other coastal ports as well as the Portland metropolitan area, places like Multnomah Channel and other places where we run into these derelict and abandoned vessels or floating homes, and cleanup is a problem. It's not, fortunately, it's not an everyday occurrence, but when it does happen, it's messy and expensive to clean up.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dingfelder.
I have a couple of questions, and I don't know who would be the best to address it, but I would be remiss since I do have the Columbia River in part of my district and a number of floating homes, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about, on page 3, line 26, I see that you're proposing an increase in the titling fee from $20 to $50. Was that in the other bill? And if you could explain that, because it's a much higher percentage increase, a much higher fee than what you're proposing for boats.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, the proposal on floating homes was in some of the amendments that we were proposing for the original bill, and the floating homes receive a one-time title fee. They don't register every 2 years like boats do. So while it seems like a significant increase, I think you have to bear in mind that it's a one-time only fee that they pay, and you're talking about a title fee on a floating home that could have a value of several hundred thousand dollars in many instances. So I think it's a small fee to pay. The number of title transactions each year is relatively few, and this would bring in some revenue from that source. When we've had one floating home abandonment that I can recall in the last 10 years at Columbia Crossings up at Hayden Island, and it was a real mess coordinating that one with DEQ and the Portland Fire Bureau and other people. In that case, we were fortunately able to burn most of it, but we still had to haul away the remains after that. It was a cost to local governments to do that.
Just to follow up. First of all, I'm glad to hear that you're not going to be burning the vessels anymore. Doesn't seem like a sound environmental practice. But I guess that was another question. Of the $150,000, would local governments be eligible to access that fund, or is that just to cover state costs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dingfelder, the original bill limited the access to the program to ports. However, in the amendments that we proposed and in the new bill that's before you, local governments would be able to participate and access this because they are considered removal authorities, and the term used in the bill. Removal authorities includes ports, city, county, and state law enforcement agencies. So county sheriffs, for example, whom we contract with for Marine Patrol, would be able to access this at the local level.
Okay, thank you.
Bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. As you're all aware, the reprinting of this legislation represents a good faith effort between the ports and recreational anglers to try and obtain a better balance of user pays, user benefits. Because as you know, we originally opposed the legislation when this was brought to the board for its consideration. And like I said, that opposition stemmed from a concern about the equity of benefits. I've spoken with our association president. I've spoken and worked with our legislative director, both who are volunteers. And we're comfortable keeping this bill moving because we acknowledge that this process doesn't wait for board meetings that associations have at different intervals. We are satisfied that this legislation does represent a better balance of benefits. So with that, I would just close and just want to thank Ken Armstrong, members of the ports. I think, you know, we've come up with some real good ideas in here. One of the issues that hasn't been addressed is the fact that we've now included this to pilings and deadheads and whatnot. And in certain circumstances, that can be a real benefit to recreational anglers. A recent example is that there was a boat launch, a recreational boat launch, that was being worked on up in the on the Columbia near the Portland area. And in that instance, they had to we were bringing in a boat ramp, and an impediment was, or a significant cost was, pilings that were in front of the access point. So those had to come out, and that was a cost that ended up having to, you know, to be calculated in. Well, this would give some funds, and then we can thereby help increase access for recreational anglers to some popular fisheries. So you know, that's an example of how the people who are paying into this fund can receive some of the benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Any questions? Jenna?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, does anyone have an estimate of the, how much total it would raise in a biennium, these additional fees?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. The revenue side of this will be somewhere slightly over $200,000 for biennium. The majority of the boats will be under in the other under 26 category at a dollar apiece. So that's where the majority of the revenue comes in. Those over 26 feet are maybe only 4,000 or 5,000 vessels in that category. So it's not going to bring in a lion's share of it. And likewise, the floating home piece is a relatively small percentage of the overall revenue. So it'll be a little over $200,000. I would also echo that with the changes that have been made, we're very supportive of the broad-based benefits that it can bring in the removing of deadheads and piling, things like that. We think that's a very positive addition to the bill. Those things are a real nightmare out there if you've ever experienced. These, if you're not familiar with the deadhead, it's a log or a tree that sometimes is just barely under the surface. Sometimes they're exposed, sometimes they're not. If you run into one of those things, it's
familiar with it.
It's the end of the trip. So the ability to deal with those problems is a very welcome thing. We support the change to the bill.
Paul, can you help me? Maybe the floating homes, I know that you won't have any problem identifying them and licensing them, but boat houses, you know, up and down all the bays and, you know, on all the rivers, there's a lot of boat houses. How are you going to go along and identify all those and license them?
Mr. Chairman, actually, floating homes and boat houses are currently titled, so we also title,
oh, are they?
We also title boat houses, as well as combinations, which are kind of a quasi. It's a boathouse and it has a living space and kind of betwixt and between, but we license those or title those as well.
Okay, and they have generally have lease agreements with Division of State Lands also, I think. Yeah.
Correct.
Representing Greenland.
Yeah, I think the big problem is going to be figuring out when those boathouses are really abandoned. They all look like they're abandoned all the time. The definition of the abandonment in the bill talks about being left for more than 24 hours on without the consent of the property owner, and then it has some other language about or other kinds of things. I mean, how will you know in seriousness when something's really been abandoned? I mean, I know how to identify a car on the side of the freeway. I know how to identify a houseboat that's fully home that's sunk, but how else are you going to be able to identify when something really is abandoned?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, we worked on this bill two sessions ago and put quite a bit of work into the due process part of this to ensure that vessels that are, you know, abandoned really are abandoned. They're not just temporarily parked. There's requirements for notice. There's requirements to place a notice on the vessel. The law enforcement, or in this case now removal authority, can only act immediately to remove it if it's in imminent danger of sinking or becoming a hazard to other navigation. But after that, there's a due diligence, a process of identifying the owner. Even if there are no identifying numbers on the vessel, which is a red flag for you to begin with, but if there are no identifying numbers, we still have to go through a due process of posting notice and doing due diligence to find the owners.
If I may follow up.
Follow up.
Yeah, I was asking the other side, not, okay, this is clearly abandoned. How do you make sure you note it? I mean, I was saying there are things that look... How do you know when something, the opposite, is abandoned rather than is really supposed to be sitting there by the side of the stream? Right? I suspect there are more abandoned things than are readily apparently abandoned. Is that not a problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, if it's at an established or attended moorage, they're going to let us know if the person stopped paying their mortgage fees and the things in danger of sinking. I think the grayest area would be if someone were to take their boat out and decide to create their own mortgage, anchor it out, leave it there unattended for some extended period of time. It would be a question mark of, well, is this just anchored out or has it been abandoned? But if it's another telltale signs, whether it's got green growing all over it and
up through the bottom,
some other things like
that. There is a question. Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Would it be appropriate to sing "Kumbaya"? These guys did such a great job.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3628 and open the work session on House Bill 3628.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3628 to the floor, or to Ways and Means, with a view pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 3628 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Brian, would you like to call the roll, please?
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Mr. Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Let's see.
Can we put that on the consent calendar? No, I'm just joking.
We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 83A2 and call Jim Witte and John Watt, please.
Thank you, John.
Here comes the guys that are after us.
I'm here to serve.
Yes. Want some coffee, Chief?
Janet, can you get us caught up to speed? And we have a letter from Senator Starr also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 83 would authorize the Department of Transportation in implementing pilot programs that study the alternatives to the gas tax to structure the fees to take account of highway congestion. You have already heard from the Road User Fee Task Force that was established by legislation last session, and they were set up to study alternatives to the gas tax out of concern that the gas tax is a declining revenue source with fuel efficiency and hybrid vehicles increasing in popularity. The legislature on the same bill directed the department to establish a pilot program. The pilot program refers to mileage-based tax, but not to charges based on travel at congested times or congested places. So you can see what the additional wording is in the bill, and there's a dash A2 amendment that was proposed to deal with some of the concerns in the Senate regarding privacy. Mr. Chair, this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and I want to introduce into the record a letter from Senator Starr, who intended to be here this morning but was not able to make it.
Morning, Jim.
Morning.
We'll start with you, Jim, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Whitty. I'm the ODOT Administrator for Transportation Funding Task Forces, and I administered the Road User Fee Task Force that is recommending this bill to you. I have with me John Watt, who's an esteemed member of the Road User Fee Task Force, and I'd also like to mention that Bruce Starr is the chairman of the task force, and he did intend to be here to address you. He has a transportation problem. The 2001 legislature sought to address the long-term viability of the road finance system by mandating formation of the Road User Fee Task Force. The task force was charged with proposing options for the design of a revenue collection system for Oregon's roads and highways that would replace the current system for revenue collection. The task force members were appointed by the governor, Senate president, and speaker on November 21, 2001. Now, House Bill 3946 gives the Road User Fee Task Force a role in designing one or more pilot programs to test alternatives to the current system. The task force recommended, and you heard last time I talked to you a couple weeks ago, about the Road User Fee Task Force work, recommends that the test involve a mileage fee and that contains a congestion pricing element. And I'll explain why in a minute. A mileage fee is a per-mile charge. And the rate would be to mirror the gas tax rate would be about 1.25 cents per mile. The task force has determined, with the assistance of ODOT and the Department of Justice, that ODOT currently has the authority to implement a pilot program for a mileage fee. No statutory change is needed. Now, congestion pricing is a per-mile surcharge added to the mileage fee for travel on specific roadways or within specific areas during periods of severe traffic congestion. The task force is concerned about whether ODOT has the authority to implement the pilot program that imposes the congestion pricing surcharge. Now, what's important to note here is that the work of the Road User Fee Task Force was mandated by the legislature. And I think they're doing a darn good job. Well, I work for them, so I got to. But I do think that way anyway. they're doing a darn good job, and they're focused heavily on the mileage fee. Now, the funding for this work comes from two sources. Primarily, the federal government, the Federal Highway Administration. It gives it ponies up about 80% of the money for this work. 20% comes from the State Highway Fund. The feds are very interested in the congestion pricing component for this pilot program. Matter of fact, it may well be that it's conditioned upon there being a congestion pricing element to the pilot. I haven't exactly directly asked that question. I don't really want to find out the answer. But I know that it was a condition towards the original grant that we do congestion pricing as a part of the mileage fee. So it's important to have this bill so that we have the congestion pricing portion so that we can test the mileage fee and continue the work for the next 6 years on the task force. Now I'm going to describe the pilot as we've outlined it so far a little bit. It covers three calendar years. In the first year, ODOT tests the technology components for a mileage fee. This first year, there will be for discovering and correcting technological glitches in the chosen technologies. In the second year, ODOT will apply the technology to a test population of several hundred volunteer motorists and impose a mileage fee to replace the fuel tax. They will not pay both. They will only pay one. There was some confusion by some members of the Senate on the Senate floor about whether they would be paying both. They would only pay one. In the third year, ODOT will apply an added congestion charge to these same motorists for travel within certain delineated areas during periods of congestion. Senate Bill 83A would allow ODOT to implement the third year of the pilot. Now, we have an amendment before you to address another concern that came up on the Senate floor, and that is the issue of privacy, which I can say, and I'm sure that the task force member, John Watt, will confirm, that the task force has been highly sensitized to this from the beginning and become ever more so with the attention we received on this issue in the media and elsewhere. So an attempt to address this directly, the Dash 2 amendments, Dash A2, I guess, are called, amendments to Senate Bill 83A before you, they address the issue of maintaining the privacy of Oregonians during this pilot who may volunteer to participate. The task force, as I said, has no interest in creating a database of vehicle movements or of tracking anybody wherever they're going. It's not interesting. It doesn't help our purpose. It doesn't help our mission. And I don't know what we would do with the information if we had it. The new language prevents ODOT from using technology in the pilot program that will have this ability. The substitute language of the Dash 2 amendments will ensure protection against any possible invasion of the volunteer motorist privacy. The amendments will allow use of an electronic odometer to calculate the number of miles a participant travels throughout the process, and will also allow periodic electronic transmission of miles traveled for the sum of it, not along the way, but the totals, for purposes of determining the mileage fee. The pilot program, as I said, is an essential step in designing a new road revenue system for Oregon. At this point, the task force does not know whether a mileage fee will be feasible as a replacement mechanism. We don't know that. The pilot program will allow us to gather important data about acceptability and whether the technology works, and then ultimately it will, of course, be the legislature's decision as to whether that happens, if even it's proposed. But without the pilot, we can't even take the next step to know whether it's worth proposing. So it's important, and I would hope you would add the Dash 2 amendments and support the bill. I know that this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I know that I talked to Senator Bruce Starr about that. He intended to talk to the Speaker about that, and, of course, we don't know the result or if that contact has happened. I would ask the committee to request... there may have been an earlier request, but request again removal of that referral to give us a chance to... I know there may be more than one task force member that may want to talk to the Speaker about this. There really shouldn't be any concerns. There's no new tax. Privacy issue will be dealt with if you adopt the Dash 2 amendments. I think they'll be dealt with anyway, but this will make it more obvious to everybody. I don't think there's many issues here that ought to be of concern. So thank you. I guess I'll let Mr. Watt take it over now.
Jim, I might ask you a question and point out that in your written testimony you say substitute language for the Dash 2 amendments, and actually it would be an additional language, right? The way the Dash 2s are written, it adds to
right.
the bill.
That's right.
Doesn't substitute for anything, it just adds to the bill.
I think I misspoke in writing the testimony.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Jim. I can't resist, but I have the a copy of the story that ran on OPB, and is it true that an unnamed senator called this bill a sinister and chilling boondoggle over in the Senate debate? I heard there was quite a spirited debate over there about this bill.
Yeah, I think that did happen, yes.
10-12,
yeah. It's really a boondoggle.
Yeah. But, in all seriousness, I would just like to comment for the committee's sake that when I was in London a couple months ago for my grandmother's funeral, the week that I was there, they were starting implementation of the congestion cost pricing program. London has one of the worst downtown congestions I've ever seen. I mean, it's just horrendous. And I was just reading a report in the New York Times, I think it ran last week, I don't know if you saw the story, and they said that this new congestion cost pricing program is working so well, I think it's reduced congestion by like over 20%. And the only disappointment was that more money wasn't being raised, because part of it is that it's a daily fee. I mean, they've decided to do it as a daily fee. So it does work. I also know that they use this technique in Singapore, and it helps their downtown quite a bit. So we're not the first ones to use this, and I'm going to be interested to see how it is.
Mr. Chair, could we do a committee visit to London and Singapore?
I'm all for it.
I think on our personal travel budgets, possibly.
Oh,
certainly not advocating for us to go there.
ODOT. I'd like to ask just a bit about the language, and I understand the paranoia, and I also understand that sometimes the paranoids are persecuted, but... I was particularly interested in the facilitates word. I'm just not sure whether that word is precise enough to help, although I'm not certain. You know, it says, shall not develop or apply technology that facilitates creation of a database. And I don't know what facilitate. I mean, anything facilitates creation of a database, I suppose. And I don't know what that means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, it would be fine if it said that creates a database. I think it's the same. I think it means the same thing. What we're after here is we don't want to have something either in the automobile or outside the automobile where we know your route for the last year. That's what we're trying to avoid, because that's one of the big concerns is that there will be a map of your history, and that is not the intention of the test.
I may follow up, sir. I mean, I don't have a big problem with this, but frankly, something could allow the creation of a database that did not facilitate, help the creation of a database, and that's what facilitate means. I'm comfortable enough with this language, but I'm not sure it really...
John, you look anxious to weigh in there.
Mr. Chair, thank you. John Watt with the Road User Fee Task Force, representing the Oregon Highway Users Alliance. Representative Greenlick, we're somewhat at the mercy of legislative council, as you well know. And having served in this august body, knowing the... results of unanticipated consequences, we would hope that you would look at the language very closely when you're in work session and be comfortable that those kinds of things don't happen. If you want me to begin, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, quite often, as you all know, government begins to react after there's a crisis. And the whole idea of this Road User Fee Task Force was to realize that there was going to be a problem out in the future. And the legislature last session, its wisdom, created this task force to be a 10-year task force to look for a solution to the future problems. We don't have a very good history here, and we do now approach a crisis in our bridges, certainly, that we're going to have to take care of. But we're also going to have to take care of the maintenance and preservation of our road system in the future. And we knew going in that there were going to be some challenges, and we've had some very lively debate and discussion over in that task force. And I can recall a meeting that we had in Pendleton when we went out there. I apologize for not knowing the name of the small town the lady was from, but it was over on the border. For those of you who know how far Pendleton is from the eastern Oregon border, she came quite some distance because she was concerned about whether or not we're going to be tracking her and her family and where they drove and when they drove and so on. And that really highlighted to the task force that there is a very real concern. We live in interesting times right now. When we go to the grocery store, we know that the store is tracking what we buy. When we get on the internet and send our emails, we know that there's somebody out there tracking us. Privacy has become a concern, and certainly in virtually every meeting that we've had on the task force, at some point or another in that meeting, we talk about the privacy issue. And So it's, as Jim mentioned, it's not the desire. And ultimately, you folks are the ones going to be making the decision on any one of the issues that the task force brings before you. But for the issue that came up with how best to move traffic, we also understand that in Oregon, there are some congestion points. And we need to be able to have a pilot program that's going to be able to address some of these congestion points. Are they in Representative Gilman's district? No, they're not. We realize that. Are they in Representative Mabry's district? No. But Representative Dingfelder, we know that you have some issues in your district. And in order, Representative Greenlick, I'm so sorry to have left you out. We know that you're a problem as well.
We've got enough for the whole between the two.
We need to be able to develop pilot programs to allow ODOT to run those pilot programs to be able to address those congestion issues. So the issue today is not about a privacy issue. It's not about the rate that a program would raise, because you're going to decide all that ultimately. This is to allow ODOT to be able to put in that highway congestion component, and that's really all it is. And hopefully the amended language will take care of some of the concerns that you have. So if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to try to do that.
Do you guys have a copy of the bill there?
Mm-hmm.
On the first page, 25 and 26, it would appear that's still in the bill. And it says the fee may include a surcharge for travel in specific places during specific times. Would that indicate to people that might have a concern with privacy with the bill that that information is going to be retained and that wording?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. What it's intended for is when you cross a line and now you're in a congested area during a period of time, not a specific time, 8:03, for example.
It's specified anyway, not specific.
The actual minute would not be kept, but they know you entered it during the congestion time, which may be from 7:30 to 9:00, let's say, and now you're in it.
What I'm having difficulty understanding is how are you going to charge these people for driving in those areas at that time if you don't retain the information?
You'll retain the information that they were there during the period, but you won't know where in the period, where in the area they were, or the precise time they were there. You'll know roughly the time period that they entered and that they were in the area, but you won't have their route and you won't have their exact time for movement in that time.
I mean, my understanding is that it accumulates that rather than says it was on July 30th that a certain time, that you have a dial that accumulates over the month how much time or mileage you spent in a congested time, and when you download it, it says you spent an hour and 15 minutes driving in a congested zone, but it doesn't say it was on Tuesday, January 5th. Is that
you would get the
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. The automobile computer would say you had, say, 150 miles during non-congested driving during the period, and you had, say, whatever it would be, 10, 20 miles of congested driving. And then it would apply two rates, one for the normal driving and one for the congested driving. The computer would retain a number of miles in each, but no placement. So all they would know is that you did enter congested area during that period. Yes.
Right.
They wouldn't know exactly when, right?
Okay. John?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to note as well that the only vehicle that would be identified would be one who agreed to be in the pilot program.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we can even speculate exactly what that pilot program is going to look like because it hasn't been developed yet.
I know that some of the concerns with this bill voiced to me from the Senate side was also the rural versus urban, and the perception by people from the rural communities that it would be grossly unfair to be charging them the same. They were assuming that there would be an equal charge per mile for driving, and they said, well, we drive 20 miles to a grocery store where someone in an urban area drives 2 miles to a grocery store. And yet, we'd have to pay more to go buy our loaf of bread than they would.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can address that. I think we're paying 24 cents per gallon gas tax now. And if you live 50 miles from a grocery store, you're going to use more gasoline than if you live 2 miles from a grocery store. So one could argue that the existing system penalizes those people who enjoy a longer drive to get their supplies. So that's really not going to change from the existing system that it is right now.
And, Mr. Chair, not only that, but this bill does not address that. This addresses only congestion pricing for the pilot. The mileage fee part of the pilot is already law. We can do it. So they're complaining about existing law. Although I do agree with Mr. Watt's argument, we already have such a thing in the gas tax.
Thank you. I guess that on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on part of that task force and sat in some of those meetings, and this bill, as I understand it, is just to try to test, and we have volunteers, so we don't have any privacy concerns. And I know, listening to some of the equipment manufacturers that were giving testimony, you could buy a credit card somewhere, like a credit card, and almost swipe it in on your transponder before you drove out, and once that credit card expired, you'd have to buy another one. So there was different forms of equipment that you're testing, and I think we can get by that privacy problem, but I understand the concern. We got to try something, see if it works, and with volunteers, I don't know that we had any jeopardy with privacy, so I'd like to see this go.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilman.
Do you have any idea in this pilot if there'll be differentials from weights of vehicles, or are all cars going to be cars and trucks, or what kind of idea do you have there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman. The pilot has to be fairly simple, because you can get too complex and spinning yourself right out of it. So for purposes of the pilot, it'll be a flat rate. That's to do anything else is to add too much FTE to figure out the problem. So ultimately, if this comes before the legislature, and if the legislature entertains these ideas in legislation, things like what the rate will be and how it will be set will be determined by the legislature. And in fact, I think the task force may be backing away from even worrying about the rate, because it'll be a politically charged issue, and you all are equipped to handle that, and we're happy to let you handle that. So, but for purposes of the pilot, really has to be flat, just much simpler.
Mr. Chair, I have one last question. Regarding the potential referral to Ways and Means, I'm just a little confused about why the referral. Is it because of the cost? Has the cost of the pilot project not been built into your budget, ODOT's budget? I guess I'm trying to understand where that's coming from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, ODOT did a fiscal on this, and there is no fiscal. So you can use your own imagination as to why. I have not been privy to exactly why there's a referral to Ways and Means myself.
Representative Dingfelder, I think what we have here is a constitutional problem.
Regarding, Mr. Chair, regarding use of the gas tax funds.
Yep. I think
got it.
Yes.
I was just curious is if the cost of the pilot project was already included in the budget, because obviously it's going to cost to administer that program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dickfelder, it's already funded. The funds have been identified, and there's nothing new.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there any other questions? Representative Greenlight.
We're not in work session, are we?
No, and it's not my intention to take it to a work session today.
Well, then let me do raise an issue. If we are going to come back with it, if there is that possibility, then I would suggest we get a dash 3 amendment that changes the word facilitate on line 4 to allow. Allow.
Would you be willing, Representative, to work with Jim and
I sense I don't have a problem with this. I think this is just the issue of the wording, and I'm very comfortable with this, but I'm comfortable with it without the amendment. But I think if people who are concerned about this issue,
and this is the big issue,
then I would I would say make that word allows, which says they can't do anything that allows the creation of a of a database that does that. I sense they don't have any problem with that at all, and I can't imagine that the LC would, so I'd be happy if we are going to get it back to have that. And that will be very specific, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I'd be happy. Hopefully we could bring it back Friday to take it to work session.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 83A2. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a letter to enter into the record from Senator Starr on the first bill, Senate Bill 179, the school zone bill. He was the person who worked out the most of the amendments with Senator Beyer. So a letter in support and explanation. So did you already talk about it?
Okay. Is there anything else for the committee this morning?
No, Mr. Chair.
2709.
If not, we are adjourned.